The Venturi's Voice podcast brings together some of technology's brightest minds to discuss all things leadership, technology, and staffing. Keep the conversation going in the Venturi's Voice Slack group and have the opportunity to meet some of our amazing guests. You can download Venturi's Voice via iTunes or via the Venturi Group website at venturi-group.com. Today's guest is Aubrey Stern, Head of DevOps at Arcadia Group. I really want to get straight into this about the perception that people have of technical people, developers, right? And actually, just before we were talking the show, you were talking about the kind of introverted nature of technical people. And from my experiences, like, I'm obliged to say that, like, that is the perception I get.
Sure.
However, I do think that we're kind of at a really compelling time now where we're almost at kind of the second generation of technical people in where we're up to now, developers, where it's so accessible to learn the skill set that you need. And it's kind of this formalized career now, you know. And a lot of people who I speak to on the show, maybe yourself included, was part of that kind of fraternity, if you like, of people who were just compelled by technology before it was a career and probably would have just done it anyway, you know, because it's really interesting. And maybe it's that generation that's brought this kind of, perception of the introvert, you know, to what we consider it to be now. And I always question whether you think that maybe this next kind of generation of people who are looking at it more a career are going to kind of change the dial and maybe bring some different personalities to the table. And, you know, I suppose, do you think that's potentially the way things are going to go? And on top of that, is that a positive thing?
So it's interesting you use the word fraternity, because I think at one point our industry was very much like that. And it was part of like being like part of a club and holding a particular skill level. And I think we were very that sort of bro culture. And I'm guilty of this in a past life as well, of creating like a very sharky, technically heavy environment where the burnout rate was high and the technical level was high. And I expected everybody to be able to do exactly what I could do with very little leeway. And I think what we've seen, especially what I've seen and what I practice, is that I've personally become a very subservient leader to my team. I really believe in creating great culture, especially in the DevOps space. We talk so much about what culture is in the DevOps space, and a lot of people think DevOps is culture, and there's an element of that for sure. But a lot of the time what we end up doing is, apart from doing obviously cloud-based stuff, we're also working with developers. And so we tend to have to come from a dev background. It really helps, because what we were going to have to do is, I mean, developers comes in all shapes and sizes. And sometimes we do get the introvert guys, and sometimes we do get like, there's almost like a natural tendency to be a bit defensive about, you know, not knowing something, or to BS your way through it and say, hey, you know, I actually know this when I don't. And what we spend so much time in DevOps doing is breaking down that initial behavior in our own team to say, actually, volunteer if you don't know something, because it's okay, we'll just learn it or teach it. And then also when we deploy ourselves into these dev teams, we're looking to build quickly a relationship with the people that we're working with. So most of the time that involves giving up a little bit of ground first and conceding, hey, actually, we're not full-time developers. We do all this other stuff as well. We're very T-shaped, so we probably don't have the depth that these devs have in that space. And what we're looking to do is to come in and build a quick relationship. So we'll say, hey, you know, I'm probably not as good a developer as you. Maybe there's something that you can teach me, or is there a better way of doing this? Like, you know, the last time I did this was a while ago. And they'll start to rapport with us, and we'll build that relationship. And then hopefully we'll get to that point where they say, actually, you know, I'd love to know how to do this thing in your space. And then we'll start to bring our skill sets and our tooling and our ways of working into that development space, with that overall goal of sort of collapsing that DevOps space, that DevOps culture, into development. So there isn't really a segregation anymore. We want to remove those silos.
Interesting. And I found it intimidating, to be honest, in some instances, being involved with technical people and having to work and collaborate with them, you know, from my experience. Do you think that again, you know, going back to that kind of fraternity concept, that with so much more kind of collaboration, like you're saying, working with developers, as you were saying, in collaboration with DevOps and various other people who are experts in other, you know, technical niches. Has that meant that there has to be a bit more openness and collaborative effort and a bit more, actually, I'm struggling with this, can you help? Because it never seemed that way. It almost seemed like the environment where you just kind of figure it out for yourself.
Yeah. So, and I know exactly what you're saying. I mean, I think I've worked in several environments that you could say were hostile. I think I've been guilty of creating them myself. I do a much better job these days of creating environments that welcome people saying, I don't know how to do this, or putting their hand up in the morning and saying, can I pair up with you? Can I come and learn this? And we actively encourage this. We love people pairing together. I'm a huge fan of people saying, I don't know how to do this. I think it's actually a skill that not many people have, you know, in our industry, especially that fear of saying you don't know how to do something. I mean, I work at that leadership level where I tend to be either head of or principal engineer on something. And so I'm not always hands-on and technical. Sometimes I'm on the business side and sometimes I'm doing that stakeholder management stuff and you know, even talking to the board. I don't always get to be as deeply involved as I'd like to be due to time constraints. And so I have to lead by example on that point. And so sometimes when I come into something, I say, actually, I might not have the background in this, or I might not completely understand it. Also, in those actions, I'm trying to encourage the people that work with me and for me to do exactly the same thing, to give up the ground, because we can really quickly get to a point, I think, where we say, hey, you know, what's remedial here? You know, where do we need to go from this? Who can quickly pair up me and teach me this thing that I don't know?
Right. Interesting. Are you one that likes this kind of failure concept? If you know what I mean by that. So I think there's a lot of people who like the fail fast, the lean,
lean
methodology. Are you one that's for that? I think it's a thing that a lot of people say that they kind of absolutely believe in. Like, to be honest, I don't think I've ever kind of mentioned it to someone and they've, you know, blatantly said, no, I don't really like that as a principle. But then in practice, I find it hard to believe that everyone's kind of on board with it to the same extent as the next person.
Nobody wants to fail, right? And I guess as you know, I think technical people inherently are definitely fall into that category of people that don't like to fail, and we feel pretty sad when we push something out and it doesn't work, or we missed something. And that's why we have things like retrospectives and postmortems, to be able to go in and say, you know, these things went well, these things didn't go well, we could have improved in this area. I actually had a startup at one point that got SEIS funding, and it taught me a few things. One, that I probably shouldn't have spent 2 years learning how to write a pitch deck to get funded. Two, that I probably would never write a line of code next time before getting funded, because again, with most of these things, like, you don't know if they're going to work. And so I, having been through the startup process and the funding process and the is something going to work process, I really do believe that at the earliest opportunity, you want to validate if you're doing something correctly, if it's right. You know, we want to get a release out to customers. Again, we use common patterns in the DevOps space, like traffic splitting, to start eating the elephant, to start breaking down the monolith, to start shimming traffic away from whatever the old site is to the new implementation. And we want to do that with the smallest possible shim of functionality to prove that our hypothesis is correct. I'm a huge believer in failing fast and pivoting where necessary.
That's a cultural thing, I suppose, and from your development over your career, was there that I think it's always a progression, right? I don't think there's ever that kind of fork in the road, make a decision on whether you're going to pursue like an out and out leadership role or just remain technical. I do think that there are companies now that are doing a better job of kind of creating alternative paths for people that don't want to go completely hands off. But still, it's a completely different job that, you know, be able to encourage an environment that maybe, you know, is okay with failure and it feels comfortable if you do something wrong and fail fast. And that's a skill set that's difficult to attain, and I think it comes along with experience. How was your kind of progression from, you know, developer into leadership role? Was it a sudden thing? Was it a subtlety? How did you kind of manage that transition to the point where you're like, actually, I've actually got to start, you know, leading people here?
An interesting one. So to give you some background, before I transitioned, I am a transgender woman. My voice would never give this one up, but if you look at my LinkedIn picture, you'll see. I used to cage fight, and I was a very typical alpha male. I'm actually 6'8" tall, so I'm a very tall, imposing person. I used to leverage that quite a lot. I would always take control. I've always been called a natural leader. And I think probably in not a good way. I think I was very, very, technically heavy. I was very light on the leadership, skills, I guess what we would consider leadership today. I ran a very technical ops team for, 5 or 6 years. Who, again, I had a high burnout rate in that team. I don't think I was particularly pleasant to work for. I don't think I created the right culture, and I quite often saw my behavior in the people that work for me. And it's something that retrospectively I've looked back at, and I think it was some of the decisions that I made and some of the ways that I behaved were completely wrong. I think estrogen has been a real eye-opener for me. I remember sitting in a meeting with some Oracle executives and feeling really angry with them. And I think this was like probably 2 or 3 months into hormones, and then starting to just well up and cry. And I looked at the guy next to me and I was like, I don't know what's happening to me. And I don't know how to handle this. And actually that's been like, that was a really frequent thing in the first year of just getting angry and then welling up and crying and not really know how to react to the people around me. And I think actually it softened the way that I handle people, and I interact with situations. I realized that the culture that we build around us, is heavily influenced by our leadership. And it's one of the reasons that I enjoy leadership positions, because I have that position of influence over what that culture looks like. So I'm able to set the tone to say, actually, we're okay to be wrong. You know, I can foster an environment where people don't feel bad about failing. That can be my responsibility, and it's not completely down to me, but I get to sow those seeds and watch them to grow, and to coach the people that I'm working with to do the same thing, and to not, you know, it's fine to have, like, I guess, a little bit of jovial fun around, you know, we failed, and at the time sometimes that doesn't happen. At the time it's probably like, you know, terrible feeling, and we'll post-mortem it and do the wash up and figure out where we went wrong and how we can improve on that. But I, you know, ultimately the way we react to those events generally comes from a top-down position, and I think, you know, I enjoy being responsible for creating a nicer place or a nicer reaction within the team.
And I also think that it kind of reduces bureaucracy as well, the kind of fail fast, more open environment. And as well, I think it actually progresses things like innovation, because if you're withholding information, then that's not for the greater good of the team, because then you're not guaranteeing that somebody else is going to not make that same mistake. So I think that there's so many benefits to creating that kind of environment. And it's really compelling, your kind of story. And, you know, it's difficult, isn't it? I think because, you know, you're kind of a competitive, you know, imposing person, as you said. You do have that arrogance, I suppose, that where you think everyone should be able to kind of do the way that you do everything as you can.
I did have that arrogance.
Yeah. And so therefore it's really difficult to create that environment that alleviates people being kind of fearful of, you know, saying that they failed. You know, it's very, very difficult. And, you know, the funny thing is I think management today is still dominated by, you know, those type of characters.
Unfortunately, yes. And I do find this very often with those CIO positions where you have somebody who's been a CIO for a really long time or been in the industry for a very long time. They're not always exposed to those cultural shifts that happen in that middle tier of the business. I think often they're very abstracted. And I think it's a scale problem. And it's something actually I'm sort of facing myself more often these days as my team sizes scale up. It was a lot easier for me to spend time with my team when they were sizes of, you know, six to 12 people. Even at 12, you sort of struggle with like the management side of things and then actually still being hands-on with people and being able to pair up and make sure that, you know, the experience that people get from your team is still there, and that the essence of how you lead and what your vision is still instilled in that team. I think, you know, you hit a scale problem, and most CIOs don't get to mix at that middle level, and I think you have to make a tremendous effort to be involved and to stay relevant. I think we get the most most value at this sort of middle tier, where we get to go through these changes, these agile I guess, you know, even watching agile and agile at scale develop has been really interesting. Some of the things that did work, some of the things that don't work, some of the ways that organizations almost prevent themselves from being successful by only changing small elements and not really following the methodology, or not really embracing or understanding what agile really is. That's been you know, a real eye opener for me. And again, it just makes me want to try and solve some of those problems. And for me, it feels like the higher up I am, again, the more control and the more ability I have to shape and change that culture. Obviously there's strategies for working in the middle tier. And if you're trying to inceptionalize change, I don't think that's even a word, but you're trying to create this element of change, that the easiest or best thing that you can do is do these really small greenhouse projects where you take something and you work it in a new way, and then you deliver immediate value and you say, hey, we've been really successful with this way of working, and try and feed that back into the business, and then do it again a couple of times and then say, hey, actually we've now done this, you know, 3 or 4 times successfully, and we've used this different model and it's not the traditional way that we work, but we've had these improvements and here's the value to prove it. Can we take a bigger risk profile on? Can we take a bigger project on? Can we apply those things to a bigger project? And, you know, things like that eventually start to feed back up into those upper echelons, and they start taking notice and looking at what you're doing, and you get a little bit more buy-in and trust. You know, I think somebody said the other day, I read that you can't do transformation or pitch transformation without trust. And that's where you need to work on that middle tier stuff.
Interesting. So I really like that as a concept. And I think that there is a resistance to get involved with the people, isn't there, for whatever reason.
It's a skill, right? It's something that you're either really great at or you're not really great at. And I think,
I agree. And it's funny actually, because this, it may or may not be connected, but I tend to think that it is. But something like, so for instance, today we decided to do dress down. We don't dress super formally here, right? But yeah. We decided to dress down this summer. And ironically, actually, it was really overcast and a little bit cooler this morning. So I walked out of my front door with like shorts and t-shirt on, thinking this was a mistake, you know. And but anyway, I came into the office and caught with our kind of operations director. We were talking about the kind of concept of dress down, and you know, my background's in startups, so I didn't even really consider the kind of dress up, dress down thing as a thing, I suppose, because I just always wore whatever, jeans, t-shirt, typically, right? But we kind of ended up having a conversation about suits and, you know, formal attire, and how it actually tends to create a bit of a hierarchical factor. And I think that the suit itself is actually just an interesting kind of metaphor, I think, for a false sense of, you know, a hierarchy that I don't know where that stemmed from, but I think there's something that's so metaphoric about that, from this kind of concept of leadership, manage what it takes, you know, strong suit, expensive suit, whatever. And the dressing down actually alleviates that, and, you know, maybe creates this kind of more open, collaborative social environment where it's not quite as obvious where the hierarchy actually stands.
So a flatter structure and shifting away from that traditional sort of matrix organization.
Exactly. And I felt that that the dress down concept was something that it may be metaphoric, but I actually think that there's a real side to it. And I think that maybe from your, you know, your experience, your kind of transition, maybe it's, you're probably a good person who's experienced that, you know, the concepts, these things that we put out there, that these visuals, you know, that have, you know, an imposing play on the way that people perceive things. So I just wondered whether you'd like had any thoughts on that. You know, I mean, I'm looking at it purely from just a dress down perspective, but I think it's obviously much more than that. You know, like you say, I think there's some kind of style there. I'll have to look it up for everyone afterwards, but I think there's a huge percentage of, you know, C-level people that are like over 6 foot tall, you know, and these are kind of these societal things that, you know, give us this concept of like security, power. And, you know, I don't know whether that they're as practical in the kind of modern era where, you know, we're now moving, we're already in this kind of technical era. I think that all these things still kind of linger and exist. And it's something that I just wondered whether you'd had any kind of thoughts on.
Yeah, I mean, certainly I've worked in startups myself, and I've worked in enterprise environments, and I've done that as a guy, and now as a woman. And there are definitely some differences. I know that, like, most of the time when you're looking to build that flat structure, it does help to have that sort of that dress code where it's very casual and easy, and it's whatever suits the people. And I think that makes people relax. Like, why make somebody dress up and wear a suit and go to work if they feel uncomfortable wearing one, right? You're going to get so much less out of that person. You know, why not just say, wear what you want to work, right? If we can get more out of you by you being happy sitting there wearing whatever you want and expressing yourself the way you want, then that's fantastic. I always felt really constrained, especially like in London during the summer, as a guy having to wear like trousers and shirts and all the rest of it, and having that really inflexible dress code in most places, that really sucked during summer. I can say on the other side as a woman that there's so much more freedom, and I feel so much happier during summer these days. That's been really interesting. I think, you know, the way you present yourself, I think certainly I've found that with my appearance that, one, I do have to hit a certain bar. It's important for me because I have, you know, challenges as a transgender woman to start with anyway. So I'm much more insecure about my appearance and the way that I dress. So I'm always trying to hit a particular bar, and I'm always I make a lot of effort on when I interview and when I come to work anyway. I'm looking to hit a particular a note or bar with people so that I get, you know, treated the way that I want to be treated. I think, again, some of that has rubbed off in the way that I lead, and so I'm very much more understanding than I used to be on this subject. I think definitely the C-level, I mean, I still see C-level people rocking around in a suit and looking a little bit old and dank, and I'd love for those people to just relax and chill out and spend a bit more time on the shop floor or the coal front, so to speak, and just breathe in the culture that we're developing so often.
Yeah, because you kind of separate yourself, don't you, if you're not doing that?
You do, and I think it's bad when you have that circle of advisors where you just sort of rely on those people and you don't really know the people that are working for you in the department, or you don't spend any time with them. I think it's really important to spend time with the team. It's something that I've said that, you know, no matter how far I rise up the ladder and no matter what position I get to, and you know, hopefully one day I do get to a C-level, But even if I did, I would still make sure that I'm spending time with people who aren't at my level, who are just working or devving or doing something, because I mean, I still want to understand if those people are happy, you know, overall. I'm still going to be responsible for that sort of stuff. And so I want to know if they're happy. And what I don't want is a fake story. I don't want to sit down with them and get fake news. I want them to tell me if there are problems. I want them to tell me if they're not happy. I want them to tell me if things could be done better, or if people aren't being flexible, and, you know, because it affects the organization that we're working in. So, you know, I do understand that it's not always feasible to spend a huge amount of time when you've got, you know, a job to do, but at the same time, part of that job is, you know, understanding the people that work for you.
Agreed. Have you felt more pressure, to perform, you know, like people put on their suit and they feel as though it's kind of their suit of armor and it gets them up and ready in the morning. That's the other side of things. I wonder whether, you know, since you made your transition, you had that kind of similar, you felt a little bit more pressure to be kind of switched on because it's, you know, maybe for whatever reason, you're getting a bit more attention, more people are talking about it, whatever the case may be. So did you feel that kind of gave you energy and you felt pressured to, you know, kind of bring it more on in the workplace?
Yeah, there's been a huge shift. It was really different as a guy just spending like 15 minutes getting ready in the morning and bowling out the door and heading to work. I think in the early, like, first year of my transition, I spent probably had 2 hours each morning getting ready and piddling around in makeup that I was really bad with, and looking like my angry teenage sister when I came to work. And I was really thankful that I had a great team around me that was very accommodating and put up with my failures. And I think you go through so many because there really isn't anybody coaching you on how to be a good woman or to be a woman in general. You're just sort of floundering through it and sort of looking around all the people around you for the best way to do it. So there's always pressure on me to hit a particular mark and a bar, and I don't want to make people feel uncomfortable. I guess I know there is a connotation or there can be thoughts that people like myself might come into your team and make it really kill the culture or make it a really terrible place to work because it's really sensitive and easy to offend. I spend a bit of time unpicking that. I'm really difficult to offend. I'm very open about my transition and about any questions that somebody might have. I think it's human nature to be inquisitive and to have questions. So I'm very forthcoming with stuff like that. And I really spend a bit of time trying to allay people's fears that things would change having me around, like they really wouldn't. I'm generally a lot of fun and very, very accommodating. And again, as a subservient leader, I really care about making the workplace a better place for you. I think I get so much more out of people that I work with and that work for me by creating a nice place for them to be in.
Yeah. Well said. You know, back onto the tech stuff, I've not got loads of time left here, but I wanted to ask about the kind of pressures of keeping up to date with the latest and greatest now. You're, again, I think one of those people that's always just compelled and will always be testing and tinkering around with things. So I think it's just kind of probably natural to you. How do you kind of portray those messages to your team and get them to be, you know, I suppose conscious of things are changing rapidly. You need to kind of invest in your own time to keep up to date with whatever tech's happening, what else might be of potential use to us. Do you find that, I think there's probably two sides to that. Do you find that you have to kind of articulate those points to your team? Or is it more down to kind of the hiring process to make sure that, you know, before you get people on board, they kind of need to be inquisitive anyway? So how do you kind of get your kind of team to invest their own time into keeping up to date with those things? Because I suppose inevitably it is important and it is part of the job these days.
Totally. I mean, you know, as organizations, most of the progress that we make in the technology space, most of the new things that are introduced are coming from the people that you know are working for that organization. And I think it's, you know, certainly the way that I interview, I'm not always looking for the technical fit. I'm looking for the people fit, and I'm looking for the your love of what you do as an engineer. I want to make sure that you haven't lost that shine. It tells me a lot when you say, hey, I'm working on these community projects, or, you know, here's my GitHub and I contribute to all this stuff. That tells me a lot about you. And I think it's really great to have people come in and be really enthusiastic about that. And again, it comes down to how you set your culture up. So I like to make time, certainly when I'm operating in like a squad based model, and we've like de-siloed DevOps, and we have our engineers sort of operating as SREs, and those guys are embedded within squads. They don't get the exposure of the DevOps team, and so we need to make time for them. So what we tend to do is do something like we let them have the stand up for the squad, and then what we might do is go and have like a little campfire chat with in quotes DevOps, and we sort of discuss, you know, what's going on in the squad, and anything that you know the wider team might be beneficial for them to know or understand. And it's also a really great opportunity to say, hey, I tried this new thing. It does this. I'm really excited about it. And then say, you know, everyone else sort of feeds back. And, you know, if it's something really cool, then you just set some side time apart and spend a little bit of time doing a session on that and walk the team through it. Because it's you know, your responsibility to create a space and create some time for this. And I don't think it's something that you need to mandate. I don't think it's something that you need to put pressure on yourself for. So don't schedule something in every Friday or every two Fridays or something. You just want to work on that culture where it's like, hey, I've got something that I'm really excited about. We will always make time to create a space to discuss that with the team or the wider organization.
Interesting. Really interesting. And, you know, for you, just on a personal level as well, what are you kind of fascinated by at the moment, technical wise? Is it AI? Is there anything, you know, blockchain technology? Is there anything that, you know, you're especially compelled by at the moment and have found yourself kind of gravitating towards as a personal interest?
So shamefully, I've not really done a lot of machine learning at the moment. I'm doing a little bit more natural language understanding with the chatbots that I work with. And figuring out how to incorporate different engines and libraries to do that. Kates or Kubernetes is obviously like a really huge area right now, and I think it's very young, and you can tell that by the number of failure stories that we hear in startups and meetups, and that's not a bad thing, but it does tell you that it's young and evolving very quickly. And there are some cool things like Istio on the horizon, which will let us do traffic splitting, and introduce like certain circuit breaker patterns into our clusters, which are really, really interesting. Again, they're not really there, but Kates, and I think we discussed this before, is on a completely different scale of stable. So what's alpha and beta and stable, in Kubernetes is very different from, I guess, other spaces. I think we kind of have to judge it on that. I think a lot of people that are using, you know, things that were classed as unstable were actually in production. So it's a really interesting space. I managed to do a little bit of Azure and the Terraform Kubernetes provider recently, which is really interesting. I think there are some other tools to control to build out Terraform cluster state as code. Again, I mean, Terra is my favorite. It's something that I think almost everybody in the industry seems to work with. It's a really great platform because we can work with almost any cloud provider or almost any thing, really, as long as there's a provider for it. And if you're used to working with Terraform, it's pretty straightforward to learn the nuances of that provider and then start working with it. I think that's probably my biggest focus at the moment.
Awesome. Aubrey, thank you so much for doing this and taking the time. It's been really interesting chatting with you. We'll leave it there for now. I've I've got a feeling I'll be picking your brains in the future, and hopefully we can do this again.
Loved it.
Maybe catch up for a beer or something next time I'm down in London.
For sure, yeah. Fantastic.
Thanks for listening to the show. I look forward to hearing everyone's thoughts on this episode over on the Venturi's Voice Slack group. See you next time.